Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Listening to Justice, a podcast series exploring all aspects of the criminal justice system with me, prison philanthropist and founder of One Small Thing, Edwina Grosvenor. Over the next 3 weeks, I will be speaking to three guests who share their different experiences and perspective of working in the justice system to form our very first mini-series. Listen as I take us through different aspects of procedural justice, starting today with Kate Gunson, Detective Chief Inspector for Hampshire.
I'm Kate Gunson. I'm a Detective Chief Inspector in Hampshire Police, and my current job, I'm responsible for criminal justice and more specifically around courts and case files and standards of investigations.
So, Kate, when it comes to policing, what does procedural justice sort of mean to you as a police officer?
So, really, within policing, we police by consent in the UK, very much so, and procedural justice is key to that because it is important that the public and our interactions with everyone, they understand why we are doing things the way we're doing them, and that we take into account our victims and witness views, and then also that people that are detained for offences get a fair chance to also put forward their side of the story. So it's very important that we follow set procedures in order for the public to have a perception that what police do is legitimate and that they wish to cooperate with us and not effectively break the law.
Okay, so my mind immediately jumps to, how do you arrest someone with their consent?
Okay, so ultimately, arrest by consent is always the best outcome for everyone. And a way of kind of detailing of how that would happen in principle is that if it was a spontaneous incident, for example, that the officer's been directed to by control room, reported by a member of the public, if it was a crime that was actually taking place in front of them, the officer would attend, knowing roughly what it was they were going to attend. They would speak to the person that's suspected of committing the act. And, you know, if I give you an example of somebody seeing someone trying to break into a shop.
Yeah.
And the police attend, the police get there whilst the act is still in progress. They get to speak to the person that's trying to break into the shop, and at the point that they arrest someone, they will give them an explanation of what it is they've been arrested for.
Okay.
And it's that interaction, that engagement with public, even, you know, members of the public who are committing crime, that is really key in ensuring that situations don't escalate and don't result in either violence from the person that they're trying to detain, or actually on public onlookers thinking that something unfair is going on and that not liking what they're seeing in the way that the police are dealing with an incident.
I guess these days you have to be really sort of careful about people filming everything, and then you don't want, I guess, people to get a view of the police, of, you know, suddenly all these videos coming out of, you know, it's like police brutality, or sort of loads of you with your knees in the back of someone and trying to arrest them on the ground, because I guess, as we see in America, very quickly people form a view, don't they?
Yeah, and it is so easy for situations to have a massive impact on public confidence across the board, and clearly the situation in America impacted on public confidence in the UK as well. And our officers are really, you know, they themselves have body-worn video, so they themselves record all of their interactions with suspects. So they know that everything they're doing is on their own body-worn video camera anyway, but they are also really aware that most members of the public now will have a mobile phone with a video record facility and will be recording incidents. It's the way society is now. And actually, you know, regardless of the fact that they will be caught on video, we clearly want to train our officers that the best way of dealing with victims, witnesses, suspects, every member of the public is treating people with respect and ensuring that through doing that, we maintain public confidence and maintain public trust in the police. That's the key thing that we aim for with all of our interactions. And that's why so many processes and procedures are in place to ensure that what we do is perceived as fair.
Right. Yeah. And so I guess it's threefold. So procedural justice is important for you, the police, to be able to do your job well and fairly and effectively. It's important for the individual who might be burgling the shop or doing whatever, because it's important that they understand what's going on. And as you were saying, the third group is the public. It's important for the public because it's basically, would you say it's like a, it's not really a PR exercise, is it? It's sort of deeper than that. It's about public trust.
It's definitely about public trust. Public trust, public reassurance, the fact that the police are there to respond to incidents of concern to members of their community, and that actually, you know, public opinion is taken into consideration and taken into account in the way that we deal with certain crime types and certain issues in communities. You know, certainly policing evolves regularly based on what's happening in society as a whole. And so we need to really be acutely aware that we are in step with what the opinion is in our communities. And very often that's achieved through the community engagement with the local officers who work in particular neighbourhoods and have a lot of meetings with community groups, community leaders, with members of the public, public reassurance. We have independent advisory groups who will very often be invited in very early in investigations just to, you know, actually be able to realise why the police are taking the action that they're taking in an investigation. So we're really conscious of having everything open to that level of public scrutiny and complying, showing that we're complying with the expectations of the people that we're serving effectively.
Yeah. Okay. So if we take the guy who's burgling a shop, maybe, let's call him Ben, and you're wandering along the street and you see this burglary taking place, could you sort of walk us through sort of, you know, what happens, then the arrest, and then through to the sort of custody suite? And at what points the procedural justice sort of come in?
Yeah, so effectively, almost immediately, there's processes that we follow in our decision making around, you know, why we would end up arresting someone in the first place. So in this instance, Ben, you suspect, is going to break into the shop. So he's going to commit a what we would call a non-dwelling burglary, potentially. That's what your suspicion is, based on what you can see in front of you, what's been reported by members of the public via the control room. It may well be that another officer is actually getting an account from somebody who's witnessed everything that's gone on. So you take into account all of the different sources of information. And sometimes this happens really quickly and really on the spot. And our officers are trained in the national decision-making model, which is basically that based on all the information that they're aware of, they will go through a process where they then we'll think, well, what laws apply to this? So in this case, the criminal law of burglary is the law that you're looking at. You've got the powers of arrest in that circumstance because it's a necessary and proportionate response to what's occurring in front of you, a crime taking place at the time that you're witnessing it. So at that point, the officer would use their powers of arrest. They would identify themselves if they weren't easily identifiable as a uniform officer. If it was a plainclothes officer, they would have to show the person that they were speaking to that they were a police officer, identify themselves with their warrant card. There's then very structured wording that is used in an arrest scenario where the person committing the crime is given their caution at that point.
Yeah, the bit we always see on television.
Yeah, and the purpose of all of these steps is that actually this is consistent and this is what happens every time somebody's arrested. Every time somebody's arrested, they are cautioned, and the reason for being given the caution is it protects their rights as an individual. That, you know, from that early initial stage, they are, in the wording of the caution, told that anything they say potentially may be used in evidence at a later stage. So they're made aware of that, and that, you know, they don't have to say anything at that stage. The arrest would take place. The person would be transported to a custody centre. And then at the custody centre, there's a check and balance at that stage where a custody officer is then responsible for authorising the detention of that individual, because, you know, arresting someone is a big deal, really. You're taking away somebody else's freedoms.
Yeah, and I imagine pretty scary.
Yeah, certainly, you know, people that have never faced that before, it is a really big event to happen, and it is really important that police officers explain clearly why certain things are happening in the way that they happen, and, you know, why they're brought into custody at the point of being presented in, they call it presented in front of the custody sergeant, the circumstances surrounding the arrest are relayed to the custody sergeant, and the custody sergeant then, as a decision maker, will ensure that what's taken place was correct and was lawful and necessary and proportionate. So all of that is recorded in detail and authorised. And then at that stage, obviously, the person's detention is authorised, and they are in police detention. It's all set around timeframes of how long we can keep people in detention without seeking further authority to keep them in detention for longer periods of time.
Sorry, how long are you allowed to keep an individual in?
So that initial period of detention lasts for 24 hours.
Okay, and then you have to let them go if there's no sort of charges can be brought.
Yeah, so basically that initial 24-hour period should be adequate length of time in most investigations to have gathered all of your information, to have obtained an account from the detained person by way of recorded interview, and to have sought a decision on the outcome. So either you're not taking any further action in relation to it because every bit of information you've gathered has led you to believe that actually in this instance, either this isn't the person or a crime hasn't been committed, so they would be released with no further action. It may be that within that 24 hours, you haven't had enough time to gather all of the relevant information needed. If there's forensic evidence to be included, sometimes that takes a lot longer to obtain than the custody, than the initial period of custody detention. So you might end up bailing someone, or you might end up releasing them under investigation without bail conditions. And that very much depends on the seriousness of the crime that you're dealing with and whether you need to enforce bail conditions to prevent, you know, further offending or interference with witnesses, all of the things that might assist with the course of justice not being affected by the individual that's suspected of committing the offence. And then ultimately, a certain number of people get charged within that 24 hours in police custody with the offence because you've reached the required standard for seeking either a charging decision from the Crown Prosecution Service or on some offences that are much lower level, police can make charging decisions.
Yeah. And at that point, they go either to prison to await trial, and at which point it sort of comes to the end of the police involvement. I'm just trying to work out where your job sort of ends with that individual, if you like, and at what point the procedural justice, you know, becomes someone else's problem.
In reality, you know, after the point of somebody being charged with an offence, the police procedural justice element continues because we're responsible for ensuring that all of the correct case material makes its way through to the Crown Prosecution Service, who prosecute the offence.
Okay, I see. So it's not just I'm getting too caught up on the actual human being heading off maybe to prison, but actually there's the other bit, which is all the information and making sure that's organised and presented properly.
Yeah, and that's the, that's key in terms of where we're really held to account around ensuring that, you know, we have the witness evidence, we have the CCTV evidence, all of the forensic evidence, if it's relevant, the suspect's interview account will obviously be transcribed and available for scrutiny by the court. And all of that work still takes place post the point at which the person gets charged with the offence. So the investigating officer's job doesn't conclude until the conclusion of a court case.
Okay, that could be years, right?
It's in some cases it can take a very long time to reach the conclusion of the court case, and you know, in complex fraud cases, you could be talking.
Yeah.
In the majority of cases, that you would hope that they would get through the court system fairly quickly, but where we are at the moment, we do have backlogs within the courts and within trials. And that's that. You know, that situation's unfortunately been made worse by the lockdown. And
yeah, I was just going to mention COVID has really sort of put a spanner in the works there on an already very sort of strained system, hasn't it? Because, you know, speedy justice, I can't remember which government or who was talking about speedy justice, but the speed that things happen is an element of procedural justice, is it not? And we don't, certainly in the courts, which is no fault of their own, that element seems to be really not working.
No, and it is clearly an element of procedural justice and people's faith and belief in the system. And we've found real issues with victims and witnesses during this time frame because their expectations have been set around when something will be in court. And then unfortunately, due to lockdown, the courts, a lot of the courts didn't operate in the first lockdown. And so contacts with our victims and witnesses, you know, a lot of them have become very disengaged with the process because of the time that's elapsed and the perception that, it's unimportant because it's been pushed back. Their case has been pushed back or relisted for a date, 6 months later than originally intended. So it's really important for our witness care teams to be sending the right messages and really explaining to those victims and witnesses what the problems are, why this has had to happen, why there's been a delay in their case and them being given their opportunity to give their evidence in court. And it has been, you know, it's a really difficult time. And there have been delays within the criminal justice system way before we went into the first lockdown, but it has only highlighted that actually when people expect a court case on a particular date and then it gets cancelled, the impact on victims and witnesses is that they then lose faith and trust in that system.
Absolutely. And I can't imagine how difficult it is if a case is taking years. You've A, got the trauma for some individuals, maybe on both sides, the trauma of the wait and that sort of awful sort of black cloud hanging over you and that date hanging over you and what that does actually. But then also the memories of people who've seen things and witnessed things. I mean, I can't remember what happened yesterday half the time. You know, what impact does that have on the credibility of witnesses?
It does have a real impact on people's memory, the time delay and the difference that that time delay makes in terms of how impacted they were at the point that the actual crime took place, and then their recollection of it up to 2 years later could be a very different thing. So it is, you know, it is very important that the justice system works effectively and efficiently, and by that I mean that things do progress in a timely manner, that case progression is really prioritised, and it is, you know, is vital for everybody, for victims, witnesses and suspects, that things progress through the system in an efficient and effective way.
And you mentioned the forensic teams a little bit earlier. And obviously they are the people who'd come into a crime scene. So say Ben had broken into the shop and sort of trashed it and stolen a few things, generally made a bit of a mess. At what point do the forensic teams get called, and do they get called by you? How does that bit work?
Yeah, so that again is very dependent on the crime type, and with police resources and austerity measures being as they have been, the forensic teams will attend scenes, particularly in cases that we would call high harm cases, so where there's been physical violence, if somebody had been stabbed, if it was a case of a sexual assault or a case involving a child or young person, then the officers initially attending would put through that request that they would want a crime scene investigator to come out to that incident.
Okay, so they wouldn't necessarily come out to a burglary to take fingerprints?
So a shop burglary, potentially they wouldn't, unless it was linked in with other crime types or unless it was something that was a specific concern in that area that we were trying to target. Unfortunately, where we are with things, a lot of cases where there may be forensic potential, we just don't have the resource to attend those crimes.
Right. And so I guess when it comes to procedural justice, then when the forensic teams come in, there's a different, almost, I mean, the same concept of procedural justice for them, but theirs is more about making sure they gather the best evidence possible in order to help the police, in order for you to get it to the court?
Yeah, I mean, the forensic teams, much like the purpose of police gathering all their other sources of information and evidence, is for that objective overview of what's happened. So, you know, although it's us that would be responsible for asking them to attend, they are just as likely to present evidence that benefits the defendant as they are to present evidence that is beneficial to the prosecution case. So they are gathering the information of you know what the scene is telling them.
Yeah.
And they're not influenced by one side more than the other. And in a lot of cases now, you will find that expert witnesses are agreed both between the prosecution and the defence, and that you used to have the situation where both sides would get their own expert witnesses, whereas now, because they are neutral and they will report on what they find, both sides will accept and agree that evidence is the correct evidence.
Yeah. Okay. And have you, in your sort of career as a police officer, got any examples of procedural justice going well, or equally, if you've got an example of something having gone badly?
Yeah, I mean, I've, you know, some of the really difficult roles and jobs that I've worked in, I've been a detective for many years now and worked within serious crime cases, with child abuse cases, sexual assault cases. And in those areas, it's always really key that the principles of procedural justice are follow to obtain the best outcome for everyone involved in that investigation. And by that, I mean, even if we don't reach what for a victim or a witness is the outcome they desire in terms of a charging decision, because the evidence just isn't at the threshold required for a charging decision, victims and witnesses are able to question our investigation. They are able, there's victim right to review within the victim's code now, that they can actually find out why their case didn't progress, what, you know, information that they may want to know, either from the police side or if it was a Crown prosecution decision, they can ask for a review of the decision making from their side. And all of that assists with procedural justice. You know, there will be court cases that I've had that have ended up with hung juries, when actually in my mind, having investigated the case, I felt it was a strong case, but clearly you have the 12 members of the jury who will make their decisions based entirely on what they hear in court. And that is our system. And you know, that is procedural justice. You're judged by your peers.
And that must be quite frustrating when you've been close to it and you, I mean, as you say, it's the right way. It's the way we do it. Whether it's the right way or the wrong way is for another pod. But yeah, it must be quite frustrating. My question actually was going to be about, I imagine a lot of it is about being able to be personable as well, and to sort of put someone at ease, even if it's someone who's been misbehaving. And so does a lot actually rest on the individual police officer's character and sort of social skills and demeanour to that sense?
Yeah, very much so. And that it is the one skill area that it is really difficult to teach people joining the police, because people, you know, human nature is such that no one person is the same as anybody else. And actually, you could have 10 different officers all attend the same incident, and all 10, it has a slightly varied outcome in how they interact with the suspects, with the witnesses, with the people, the members of the public observing. And I think they have all the tools so that in practice procedural justice will be used and non-judgmental when speaking to members of the public, respectful, empathy, compassion, all of the things that we want all of our officers to portray at incidents. But you can't get away from the fact that human interaction is such that on occasions, the way an officer speaks to a suspect, a victim or a witness, the reaction they receive back is not what they were expecting. And by that, I mean, we have incidents where officers end up getting assaulted at incidents that they attend, that things escalate, that other staff have to be called to those incidents, that victims completely disengage because they didn't like the way the officer spoke to them when they attended. And so the communication and the ability of police at initial incidents is key. And it's also key around setting expectations for victims and members of the public around what's actually going to happen with this incident, and not promising them the world when actually that outcome may never have been achievable. Making sure that we're honest from the start around what we can achieve with what is being reported to us, and that we stick to what we've said to people. So very often we will do what we call a victim contract, whereby the investigator will agree with the victim in a crime to update them over a set period of time. And clearly to the victim, some, you know, on occasions, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to them. And so that update from that investigator is the most important thing that they are waiting for. And it's just ensuring that our officers are aware that they need to appreciate things from the point of view of the victim, but certainly stick to what their agreements have been, and certainly update people when they've said that they're going to update people, and make sure that people stay engaged.
Exactly. And maybe on the day on the day that they said they'd do it, because, you know, there's nothing like, I'm sure lots of people listening will have dates and times in their mind when they either heard bad news or something terrible happened to them. And then all you want to do is talk to the people that can maybe help you out. And you remember, don't you, if someone says, well, I'll call you at 4 o'clock on Saturday, you'll be sat by the phone from about 3:30 waiting for that important call. So yeah, I can see how that element of it would be so crucially important.
Thank you so much, Kate, for joining me today to share your experiences of working within the police force. Listen next week to hear our next segment of the Procedural Justice mini-series, where we'll learn more about forensic investigations from Jo Millington, a forensic scientist.
Links relevant to this episode can be found in the pod notes below. If you enjoyed listening, we would love it if you would subscribe. Also, rate, review, and best of all, share this episode. Justice is produced for One Small Thing by the London Podcast Company.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.